Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Lehrer on WNYC now. Affordable housing available in Brooklyn Heights, Dumbo, and downtown Brooklyn, but nobody who lives around there seems to qualify. Let's talk about this new answer to one of the most frequently asked questions we get on this show, and that is, when politicians talk about affordable housing, affordable for whom? Back with us is Barika Williams, Policy Director at the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development, ANHD. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me back.
And these are posh addresses, like 60 Water Street, a.k.a. Dock Street Dumbo, and 66 Rockwell, which I looked up its advertising online this morning, luxury high-rise apartments in the heart of downtown Brooklyn. Are you familiar with these buildings and their empty, affordable apartments?
I am. So in the case of 66 Rockwell, they, at least as most up-to-date as I know, still have some affordable units that range in the mid-500s to $700 range.
Rent per month. So low.
But primarily, and some of this is how it matches up. There are units that are primarily available are studios and one bedrooms, and they are looking to fill them for first preference for local residents of Community Board 2 in Brooklyn. But the question is not just what the incomes are, but what the qualifications and requirements that the developer is putting on those units are for local residents.
Such as
credit checks, right? So one of the city sets the income bands, but the developer is able to set the credit requirements at their own discretion. So you can see where it would be somewhat difficult to potentially have an 800 credit score and be able to qualify for low-income housing.
If you make $25,000 a year, you probably don't have a 750, 800 credit score.
Exactly.
Huh. So the law doesn't govern that?
No, the law doesn't govern that. And it's one of the cases where we really see a huge advantage to local community development corporations, those local nonprofits who do affordable housing development, because they're more flexible. They look at, who are my residents? Can I enroll you in a financial preparedness course that I also offer as a part of my organization to get you ready, to get you able to take advantage of this unit? They think more flexibly, whereas we see with some of these big developers, and Dermot is a case and a bad actor that's been in the neighborhood for a while.
Dermot, you're calling them a bad actor, owns what?
So Dermot is a developer that's been doing some predatory equity and speculative purchases in Community Board 2 in Brooklyn for a long time.
Speculative purchases often of rent-stabilized apartments to try to pressure the tenants out so they can flip them to market rates.
Exactly. So Pratt Area Community Council in the area has worked with close to 10 buildings in the area that are rent-stabilized buildings where they've seen regular complaints from tenants in Dermot buildings.
And that same company has been given the right to develop new market rate housing, but with affordable set asides.
Yes, and I want to be clear also that this is them taking advantage of a state program. So this is state money and the state 421A developers tax break. There isn't city money and there isn't city subsidy in this project.
So listeners, help us report this story. Anyone out there who's been looking for apartments and affordable housing programs, but you find that you either make too much money or too little money for where you want to live. We'll get back to that too much money, too little money question. 212-433-WNYC, because part of what's been reported is that there aren't enough people making that low income matches with the way the units are set aside in those relatively tony these days neighborhoods of Dumbo and downtown Brooklyn and Brooklyn Heights, regardless of credit score. So any of you finding that you are looking for affordable housing, but there's no match with what you qualify for and what's available? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9222. 9692, or any landlords having trouble finding the people who qualify for the affordable units that you are trying to rent under the law. If there's a world of mismatch and disconnect out there, let's hear about it. 212-433-WNYC, or anything else you want to ask Breek Williams about the issue, 212-433-9692. Where does the local resident priority end? In other words, is it just that residents of the immediate area, in this case Brooklyn Community Board 2, get first priority on these low-income units, or that people with low incomes from elsewhere in the city are actually prohibited from getting these apartments at all and from moving into those neighborhoods?
No. So it's definitely not the second case. The system is set up so that local residents get first priority for 50% of the affordable units. And that's in the interest of there's a new affordable housing development going up in my neighborhood. It would be great if I or my neighbors get a chance to buy into that, to live in that.
It sounds like a common sense bulwark against gentrification or against being gentrified out of a place that you already live.
Right.
At least the neighborhood where
yes.
you already live.
Yes. And normally what we see is the opposite circumstance, which is that the affordable housing is priced too high. And so many developers oftentimes say that they can't fill their 50% preference, neighborhood preference. And so then, of course, start looking citywide. There are always people who can apply citywide. That's not the case in these downtown Brooklyn buildings. Downtown Brooklyn has one of the poorest census tracts in all of New York City with incomes of $17,000. Farragut Houses is right down the street. So it's not as if these residents aren't in the neighborhood.
Stacy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. I am a teacher. I currently live in Williamsburg, but I make $60,000 a year. I've tried to get into affordable housing several times, and I'm always priced out. Like, I don't make too little. But then where else am I supposed to live? Because I can't afford an apartment by myself anywhere else in the city.
So I think Stacy is a case where you're right on that bubble. You're right above the 60% AMI, area median income, which is where a lot of the federal income dollars come in. And so you're just nudging above qualifying for some things, but you're still well within the affordable housing income band. So you're within that, $30,000 a year to what goes as high as $135,000 a year that qualifies for different slots and different types of income affordable housing. I'd look at things for you that target incomes around 70% or 80% AMI is what you want to look for.
Okay, cool. So I'll check that out.
Thank you very much. AMI, average median, or area median income.
Area median income.
Right. And can you give people like a general guideline, because I'm sure there are many callers like Stacy, of where to look for these things? Like, how do people even know where the affordable housing units are being created that are targeted for their income groups?
So the HPD has on their website and list on their website many of the units that come up as a part of the lottery process. Then there are a separate set of units that come up through NYCHA, which often has a long wait list and very difficult to get in. But then also the other pieces to ask around. Every time you see one of those new developments going up in your neighborhood, go in, ask the property manager in the building, are there any affordable units? What are their AMI levels? And, how can I get an application and qualify?
James in Windsor Terrace, you're on WNYC. Hi, James.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your guest is bringing a lot of great information. One of the interesting things to me was that at the beginning she mentioned that most of the units are studios and one bedrooms. And my family and I actually applied a couple of years ago for an affordable housing in Navy Green, which is down by the Navy Yards.
Right.
And while we got into the lottery, it was very difficult, one, to prove our income, and two, if these neighborhoods are trying to create communities of middle-class families, where does a family with three kids go with mostly studios and one bedrooms? And then you've got to prove your income year upon year, and if your income increases, you're under the threat of being moved out of the unit. So it's difficult for the stability that family needs, for the space that a family needs to find what's necessary for a middle-class family.
Right. So I think you bring up a lot of good points. One thing to clarify is that in most of these units, in almost all of these cases in city housing, once you qualify at the income level and you're into the unit, you are into mm-hmm. the unit. And you do what your how your income changes over time does not knock you out of qualifying for the unit.
Huh. Does it affect your rent?
In a lot of the current city subsidized housing, no. So the new construction, it doesn't. It doesn't necessarily raise or lower your rent. But let's say your income drops and you can't afford to pay the unit anymore, then you could potentially be evicted from the unit. Mm. Now, I think he also brings up a great point, which is where are we building larger size family units, which is another concern in the case of downtown Brooklyn. We've got family sizes of 3 and 4. We see the same thing in the Bronx and in parts of Queens. And some of our new production is skewing on the studio 1 and 2 bedroom size. And that really doesn't work for larger families.
And so are there is most of the targeting for people without families or larger families? And is this a mismatch, in your opinion, of supply and demand?
So, I mean, ANHD looked at this in our real affordability report. On average, it evens out. The average household size and the average new units that we produced, affordable units that we produced over the past 12 years, is pretty much even. Where it starts to skew is that we put a lot of units in one neighborhood that might be on average the same as the citywide, but are very different than the local neighborhood.
Huh. So what can James do, for example, to broaden his search to maybe find something where his family size and the available affordable apartments do match up?
So I would suggest looking at some additional and different neighborhoods, and then really focusing on looking for 3 and 4 bedroom units. And as you go higher in terms of units, you might have to adjust where you look in terms of the AMI levels, those area median income levels, because they're prorated by household size.
James, good luck. And if we're talking about apartments that are targeted for too low incomes in Dumbo, Brooklyn Heights, maybe downtown, though you say there's, you know, certainly low-income population downtown Brooklyn, there's almost been the opposite controversy on the Upper West Side, where I believe some plans for lower-income affordable units and new luxury buildings were reclassified for more middle-income residents. And critics say, oh, they're just trying to keep the riffraff out. Does it make sense to do it that way, like economic integration, but not necessarily forcing a very rich and very poor mix by government design if that doesn't pre-exist in the neighborhood?
So I'd say we don't have a problem with too low. That's actually not a challenge in the city. And when it comes to middle income housing, I think the real challenge is, what are we talking about when we say middle income? It's really a big range, and what people think of when they say middle income and what we mean when we say middle income oftentimes are very different things. Middle income affordable housing right now, you're going to be paying rents between $2,700 and $3,300 for a 2-bedroom apartment. And that's not what a lot of people have in mind.
And that's already a regulated or a subsidized rent, because
yes,
a 2-bedroom apartment would be even more than that market rate. Doesn't that depend on where? Like, that might be true, you know, in some of the wealthier neighborhoods, but there are a lot of neighborhoods in the city where you can get a 2-bedroom apartment for well under $3,000 a month?
Absolutely. And this is one of the big challenges for affordable housing advocates all the time, because these numbers are calculated off of that thing, area median income, which is done by the federal government. Mm-hmm. It includes the New York metropolitan region. So not only are we not talking about the affordability of your neighborhood, we're calculating this using Westchester County and parts of New Jersey and parts of, right?
So when you use that AMI stat, area median income, that's not area median in East New York,
no,
area median in Williamsburg, area median in Bayside. That's the whole metro region, including Scarsdale and everything else.
Exactly. And neighborhood area median incomes can range from everything from the middle of the neighborhood in parts of the Bronx being at 26% of AMI, and all the way up to, in other parts of the city, 130% of AMI. So the middle of the neighborhood, middle income people and residents in the neighborhoods range vastly in New York City.
And that isn't taken into account by city policy and where these affordable units at what income levels are targeted. neighborhood by neighborhood under the current administration?
That wasn't taken into account under the past administration. And I think we're optimistic that the new administration is looking at this in a more neighborhood specific case by case basis, really trying to make sure that affordability means something for the neighborhood and not just affordability kind of in the larger, broader general terms.
Want to hear one more person's situation? Eileen in Little Neck, Queens. You're on WNYC. Hi, Eileen.
Hello there. This is I'm a first-time caller. And while I was explaining to your screener, I think you had a similar scenario. So my situation is I live in Little Neck looking to move into Manhattan, can't afford any market value that they have on the market. So I looked on the government website. And for me to even look at a studio, I have to make an income of $39,000, whereas I make $69,000. And I make too much money to go for a studio, but I make too little money to afford anything else. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I think one of the challenges is that it might be difficult, but you might need to look at some other areas beyond Manhattan. It might not fit your preference. But the other thing is that, remember, we're saying affordable housing is a big band in terms of rents and in terms of incomes. The city qualifies affordable housing for somebody making everything from $25,000 and $30,000 up to $135,000. So it might be that you're focusing on the wrong band, and you might need to shift from looking to 60% AMI studios and one bedrooms instead of 30 or 40% AMIs for studio and one bedrooms.
What would you say, Eileen, to some listeners who may have heard your situation and are thinking, well, wait a minute, why should the government subsidize or set aside apartments for somebody who makes $69,000 a year and can afford to live in Little Neck, apparently, but wants to move into Manhattan, which is more desirable? Why should you be subsidized?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I just feel that I could never, ever afford to live in Manhattan, when I think I do make a very good living, but Manhattan is just very untouchable completely for me. So it's a little frustrating. So I thought at any means that I could even afford it would to be part of the subsidized housing.
Eileen, thank you very much. And does that raise a policy question here, Barika, as well as, you know, how to help an individual who may be able to find something that that's a match?
It does raise a policy question, right? I mean, and part of the question is affordable housing there to subsidize residents choosing to live wherever they want in whatever type of housing they would like? Or is it really to make sure that people have secure, stable, affordable housing that doesn't force them to make bad choices about their health care and school and, you know, access to jobs and being able to pay for food? So there are some people who are really in dire straits and having to make difficult choices. A lot of New York City is rent burdened and paying 30 to 50% of their income every single month for their housing costs.
So just to wrap it up and look to the future, we talked about some of these particular buildings that have been in the news for having trouble finding people with the right match of qualifications and incomes to take the affordable apartments in otherwise luxury buildings like 66 Rockwell and 60 Water Street. The DNA Info article on this reminds us that some other buildings with affordable units are going up in roughly that same area, like Atlantic Yards, finally, BAM North, and City Point Phase 2. Will all of these have the same problem?
I think what's really going to depend is I'm optimistic that a lot of these projects won't have the same problem, because I really think a lot of these problems are about setting unrealistic qualifications given the residents that you're targeting, right? So extremely high credit requirements for residents who are making $30,000 a year, $25,000 a year is unrealistic, right? These are folks who are rent burdened, who are struggling to pay their rent every single month. That's why they're coming and applying for this housing. So you can't expect them to come to the door with perfect numbers that match somebody who's paying $3,000 for a two-bedroom apartment.
Barika Williams, Policy Director at the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development, ANHD. You know so much about this, and you help us so much every time you come on. Thank you very much.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
All right. It's the Brian Lehrer Show, Africa Summit, as President Obama holds his in Washington. Tell everybody something most of us don't know that has changed in the last 5 years in the African country that you have ties to. for better or for worse. Busayo in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. Where are you from?
I'm from Nigeria. I was actually born in Boston, Massachusetts, but I was raised in Nigeria.
Uh-huh.
And for the last 10 years, I don't know, like 14 years, I go back and forth. I have family members there. So about twice a year, every year, I go to visit. And a great deal has changed. I think, you know, the proliferation of cell phones really can't be understated. I think that really changed sort of industry and commerce. In terms of most Nigerians have a cell phone sort of across the economic range, so from the very poor to the very wealthy. In terms of what people are buying and, you know, sort of cars on the street and just, you know, kind of fancier homes, like you really see the change in economic growth, certainly in the last 5 years, and a lot of infrastructure development as well. I do think that the presence of Chinese and Indian folks is something that is also just... you know, just looking at people on the ground. You know, typically when I used to go home, you know, you could go 2 days and not see anyone that was not black. And now, you know, you sort of see a lot of, especially in the markets, you see a lot of Chinese men and women there. I do think something needs to change in terms of the American perception of Africa. I do a lot of work in fashion. I produce in Nigeria and sell here.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of times when I'm at market, people say, oh, are your clothes made by, like, women in a collective? Or, like, you know, are these, like, benefiting refugees? Like, people literally ask these questions here. And I'm like, no, these clothes are made by, you know, men and women who have their own businesses in Nigeria. So I definitely think that this perception of, around aid really has to change. And I think that's where the U.S. kind of has really been really kind of screwed up in a way, because I think China and India kind of just took Africa on its own terms. And I even hate to use the word Africa because I can only speak for Nigeria.
Right.
But I think they took it on its own terms and went there and tried to develop new markets. Where I think the U.S. is just this perception, like, you know, people still ask questions that are really mind-boggling about, you know, when I was going home, like Boko Haram, and like, you know, are you going to be in danger? And I understand that sentiment, like wanting to care, but it's also such a diverse place. And so when something is going on in one pocket, you know, if something was going on in Los Angeles, you wouldn't tell someone not to go to New York, you know, and it's really the same thing. Like, there's such a diversity throughout the continent. And I really just hope that Americans, and I hope the summit is a step in the right direction, to really be more open and realize that, you know, Africa has arrived and what we've always thought about it is totally changing. And I think Indian folks and Chinese have certainly realized that, and they're there, you know, kind of making their money, really.
Busayo, great call. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Solomon in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Solomon.
Hey, how you doing? Good show, Brian.
Thank you. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire.
Uh-huh. West Coast
and,
of Africa.
Since after the war, Ivory Coast is coming better now. With the road and with the president. The president doing so good. Everybody's coming together. We all say hi to each other. Before, we didn't like each other. Now, all of a sudden, we all like each other. Maybe those people didn't like the president before. Now, they like him because there's no more war right now. So, you know, that's what I was trying to say.
After the Civil War. So what do you think about what President Obama is doing? Do you think there are particular opportunities for investment, certain sectors of the economy in Ivory Coast that Americans should be hip to?
Exactly. Americans, they would be glad to be in Ivory Coast with the investment. There's a lot of stuff in Ivory Coast. People don't know about it. Now, all of a sudden, we all know about it with the diamond and on the oil, everything is good.
Solomon, thank you very much. Good luck to you. And Abdul in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Abdul.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for picking my call. My name is Abdul Rashid. I'm from Ghana. I go to Ghana a lot. Brian, I think one of the basic things that have changed in Ghana is our currency. The currency has fallen almost about 40%, depreciated almost about 30%. Within the last couple of months, because Ghana is completely import-oriented and the government has done nothing to do to change this. And I think that's a very big problem. There's no way we will ever get foreign investment, because you cannot invest your money in an economy. To $10,000, you invest in it, the following year, it becomes $7,000.
That's terrible deflation. Do you think that...
Completely. Even now, we are having stagflation in Ghana, completely.
Yes.
There's stagflation in Ghana.
Stagflation.
No economic growth, and there's inflation in the country. Complete stagflation.
Now, when you say it's an import-oriented economy, are people importing, you know, the necessities of life into Ghana rather than producing?
We base our, our, the whole economy is based on the dollar, completely. It's based on how what happens with the dollar.
What could change? What could Ghana be producing more for itself or for export?
There are solutions. The solution should come from our legal system. We have an inefficient legal system. We don't have an independent judiciary, and that breeds corruption. That's the only way we can change. We are not even Ghana, most African countries. If they can change these things, we change in Ghana. But until we change our legal system and change our character, believe me, we will always, no matter how much they invest in Ghana, nothing is going to change. Because if you don't have any innovation to change the way people work in the country or to bring some sort of innovations, the only thing you know is corruption. That's the way only you can enrich yourself. Brian, we struggle in this country, invest in Ghana, and everything, it becomes decimated completely within a short time.
And President Obama did mention this yesterday, that obviously internal corruption has to change, has to be improved in a number of African countries for the investment community to feel confident in putting money there for economic growth. Do you think this is something that something like the Africa Summit with President Obama there can help with, or does this only have to be generated internally?
I can tell you it's going to change things. You see, Ghana is one of the most democratic countries, not only in Africa, but in the world. There is peace in Ghana, and we have well-educated people in Ghana. But the problem is with the corruption, you see. But what Obama is doing, if they can maybe infuse certain ideas in our people and then change the mindset, I think it's going to work out.
Thank you very much for your call, Abdul. I really appreciate it. Jen in Freeport, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jen. Oh, I think we have a bad connection. Try again.
This is from Freeport.
Hi. Okay, I think I have you now. What country do you have ties to?
My brother-in-law is an agricultural minister in the country of Tanzania.
Uh-huh.
He's been there for about 20 years. And in the last 5 years, he's been able to bring beekeeping as one of his programs to the area. And what it's done is that it's brought a level of commerce to the area, and it's brought really a sense of pride. He's teaching, you know, the locals who are a 3-day drive from Dar es Salaam, which is the capital, very, very rural area. He's giving them a sense of pride, a sense of ownership, a sense of commerce, a sense of income, and it's really changed where he lives for the better, I think.
Now, why beekeeping? I mean, people in Brooklyn may consider beekeeping a kind of boutique agricultural pursuit in a country that maybe needs much more large-scale stuff. So how would you contextualize this for us?
Well, one of the things that he really tries to convey is that he doesn't want the white man to come in and fix things. He wants something that's sustainable, and he can teach the locals a skill, but he doesn't want it to disappear or fall apart after he leaves. And this is a very sustainable program that with very, very little money can produce tremendous benefits.
All right. Jen, thank you so much for your call. And Joseph in Secaucus, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for accepting my call. I would like to say, you know, I run a Pan-African media organization in Africa, and went around to different countries. And what we have seen in Africa in the last 5-10 years is something we have not seen in the last 300 years, where we have had relationships with the European continent. And I say this thanks to China, thanks to China, thanks to China, who relentlessly, positively engaged with African countries and showed a remarkable infrastructural development where people in the rural areas can go to hospitals, can go to schools, can go to the cities with their agricultural produce and sell in very short time. This being said, it doesn't mean there is no corruption, there is no bad governance, but you know, we are moving forward, and things have changed for better.
Joseph, let me ask you a follow-up question, because you're the second caller to bring up China more than the West investing in Africa, and as the other caller from Nigeria put it, taking Africa on its own terms, and your ties as you said, are to Ethiopia and Kenya, which is all the way on the other side of the continent in the east. Do you think, though, that as we've sometimes heard in the news in this country, that China is engaging in a kind of neocolonialism of its own in Africa? I've heard, for example, that they bring in Chinese workers. They need jobs for their own people, so they bring in Chinese workers to take the best jobs. And so they're using Africa for their own enrichment, but not really sharing so much with the local population. Do you think that's not so true?
No, let me tell you, this is I really appreciate that you brought this issue up. Listen, China brought laborers from Chinese laborers to African labor market. What does that do? There is indirect transfer of knowledge to Africans. Let me give you an example. Road construction, building construction. For instance, in Ethiopia, there were contractors who used to build, rural roads. But when Chinese came with their workforce, Ethiopian counterpart workforce look at what they're doing, and they picked up. That's an indirect knowledge transfer. And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? Why do we highlight the negative aspect of China bringing its own labor force? As I see it today, for instance, I used to advocate that maybe the Western countries should promote a mechanism that their citizens go with their money and live like locals and invest like locals and work like locals. In that way, there are things, there is a knowledge, potential knowledge.
Transferred knowledge over time. Joseph, thank you so much. I really appreciate your call. And since I mentioned that we got calls thanking China for the investment from East Africa and West Africa, we're not going to have time for Ibman in the Bronx, but he's saying the same thing originally from Uganda, so that's Central Africa. So China is there all over the continent for whatever complex mix of good and bad, but you hear, you know, our thoroughly unscientific small sample of Africans from around different parts of the continent calling to thank China for its presence. And all right, well, I think everybody else learned a few things there. Our Brian Lehrer Show Africa Summit. Thanks to all of you as the experts, you as the guests, as President Obama holds his official Africa Summit in D.C., concluding today with approximately 50 members. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And it's not warming, it's dying. Five words, one image. The latest project from legendary designer Milton Glaser, the man behind the I Love New York image, the DC Comics logo, his colorful Bob Dylan poster, you know that one, the Brooklyn Brewery logo, and lots, lots more. Oh, he also co-founded New York Magazine, by the way, 1968. His latest design is aimed at raising awareness around climate change, something Milton Glaser thinks we just don't talk about enough. So Milton Glaser is here now to talk about the design and the issues. Milton, always an honor to have you back in the WNYC studios. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Glad to be here.
And listeners, we posted the image on our page, so you can see it there and follow along as we talk, since we're going to be discussing something visual. If you can get there by your phone or computer, whatever, go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. But for those who are listening on the radio and can't see this design, Milton, want to describe it for us?
Well, it's easy to describe. It's just a black dot with a little bit of green at the bottom. Either Earth is dying or it's beginning to grow again. And my preference would be that it was beginning to grow again. But for the moment, I have no evidence of that.
So the image represents the choice. And it is, there's no, if I'm looking at the right version of it, there's no lettering on the green dot. It's black, as you say, over most of, like, the top three quarters of it, with an arc toward the bottom fading up, really, to green. And the lettering is above it that says it's not warming, it's dying.
Well, there is no lettering on the button itself. It's only promotional material
that
follows it.
So the button is just
the button lives
the black
by
and the
itself.
Green.
It is without a narrative except for one that we tell people about after the fact. But as you know...
Right. So you're hoping that image by itself with no text is going to take on a meaning that people will know and come to understand.
Well, the relationship with between dark and light, there's always something people implicitly know.
Can you walk us through the design process with the green circle or the globe? Did you start out thinking you wanted to represent Earth, or did you try other color schemes? How did this go in your head?
Well, that's funny, the questions you ask. It started with the idea maybe it would be a good idea to save the Earth. And if from a designer's point of view, what would you do to go about it? And the question is, well, why don't people work together to do this? One of the great mysteries of collective life is the fact that you have all these thousands of ecological groups and they won't work together. They all have independent initiatives. They work by themselves. They're very happy working by themselves. But they won't do anything together. And that seems to me not only puzzling, but incredibly frustrating.
I've read a few reactions to it online, including people describing it as a green earth with a black band of smoke over it. Some have said, no, it's a green earth with oil seeping down over it, and that's what the black is. Maybe you were saying before that the black simply represents death of the planet. Does the artist want to settle the debate between oil and smoke and any other symbol?
Well, in terms of symbology, the struggle between good and evil, dark and light, up and down, is always the essential material you're working with. But here the idea is that the end of green is a specific kind of reference to the ecological issues involved. But it's puzzled me, as I say, why there was no collective effort. And part of it is that any initiative in our climate of sort of negativity is immediately rejected by the self-interest of other parties. So if you say the Earth is coming to an end, somebody will immediately say, no, there is a dentist in New Jersey who says it isn't. And before you know it, it is not a fact, but a subject of argument. So the idea is that this button doesn't originate anywhere. It actually started as an initiative of the School of Visual Arts, supported by David and Tony Rose, to submit this to all the art schools in the country and let the kids wear them first, being the most benign and optimistic segment of the population we could find. And that's what's going to follow the posting of this big poster on the side of the building. And what we're hoping is that if there are enough witnesses to the fact that we are conscious of this, something will happen. This is not an attempt at an ideological stance. What it really attempts to do is to recognize or to acknowledge what is in the Buddhist sense.
And with the tagline, is that one of the reasons that you made sure to use the word warming? Because as an image maker, as a designer, you must know that a Republican consultant some years ago came up with the phrase climate change in an attempt to replace global warming as, you know, the way this phenomenon is commonly talked about, because it seemed less threatening just to say climate change. You say it's not warming, it's dying.
Well, again, global warming in its own way sounds sort of reassuring and comforting.
Even that's not so good.
That's terrible. So you begin by attacking the phrase itself, the word, and what the word means, because the truth of the matter is that the Earth is dying. And wouldn't it be nice if today was the beginning of the most important date in human history, which is the date we decided not to let the Earth die?
Not changing, warming, not warming, dying, if you want to talk to Milton Glaser, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And this is WNYC FM HD in AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey public radio. How can people get this button?
Well, there's a website, www.itsnotwarming.com. And you'll get for $5, and with the cooperation of the Busy Bee Button Company, they will send you five buttons. And all the money is used to manufacture more buttons. So this whole campaign is actually self-funding. We don't have to raise money to produce the buttons. You raise the money by sending in your $5. And what we're hoping is that it goes viral, that people post it and send it to friends and people they love, and that it circulates the world within a couple of weeks. and that half the people on Earth wear the button soon enough, and then the concern can no longer be denied.
And you're encouraging people to take pictures of themselves wearing the button selfies, and post them on social media using the hashtag It's Not Warming. So there's the hashtag, folks. If you take the selfie with the button and post it, hashtag It's Not Warming. Now, you obviously flourished in the era of paper posters and big banners. Do you think that social media has changed the design world?
Well, I am a complete Luddite and moron about all advances in technology. But I could see that this extraordinary viral effect of ideas now entering into human consciousness is unprecedented. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to take advantage of that.
Mimi in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Milton Glaser. Hello. Mimi, is that you? Mimi, are you there? Mimi can't hear me. Let's try. Joan in Westchester. Joan, you're on the air. I think people can't hear me. Maybe we're having a technical problem with the phones. Well, I know that Mimi on three. Let us try her one more. Mimi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, Brian. Now we can hear you too. Hi.
Hi. I want to respond to something that Milton said. I'm thrilled that someone of his stature is helping to raise awareness. I think we should all be doing everything we can to raise awareness of this issue. But in fact, it's not entirely true that environmental groups are not working together. There is a People's Climate March being organized for September 21st when the UN has an emergency meeting on climate change. And there are literally hundreds of organizations that have come together and are working on this climate march, many of them environmental groups, but also there are a lot of unions that are involved. There are many community groups of all kinds, religious organizations. And the climate march on September 21st has also inspired a number of artists. I have some very beautiful posters here. A lot of us have been putting these posters up around the city. I'm looking at one right now that says Defend Our Mother. It's a mother and child image with an Earth sunburst behind it. I think it's very beautiful. Another one shows a life jacket, which is pretty much the size of the whole 11 by 17 poster, People's Climate March. We are the storm we've been waiting for. So I want to inject, I totally understand the idea that we've created tremendous havoc with the planet, and there is reason for despair, but I think that
also reason for hope in the way groups are coming together.
And I think we want to inspire ourselves, and
right.
I worry that there are a lot of younger people who are very fatalistic about this, and I want them to be inspired and not just feel like, you know, it's game over by now.
Mimi, thank you. Milton?
No, thank you. Anything affirmative about the subject is wonderful. I mean, anybody who's doing anything and any group that's getting together and so on is wonderful. The only thing is the scale of the operation. That it seems to me that if you can engage half the world, you're in good shape. If you get a couple of 100,000 in a march, it doesn't have the same kind of meaning. But every manifestation of this kind of opposition to the status quo should be encouraged, and I'm thrilled that there's going to be a march.
That's going to be a big thing in September. I'm sure you know about it. Maybe, you know, hundreds of thousands of people will be wearing your button. I don't know if you're going to be distributing them physically at that march as well, but this is something people are going to be hearing a lot more about as it comes closer. There's an official climate summit that's going to take place, I guess, in conjunction with the UN General Assembly around then, and what organizers are hoping is going to be one of the biggest marches ever or rallies ever here in New York, September 21st.
That's terrific.
Diane in East Williston, you're on WNYC with Milton Glaser. Hello, Diane.
Hi, Milton. I worked with you at Queens College. You designed our wonderful logo.
Oh, thanks.
I just wanted to say that perhaps global warming is what you mean rather than global warming, that it's just to attract people's attention to the problem.
Sure. Anything that works.
Okay, using the word warning instead of warming, I guess that's another language way to go about it. Before you go, there's an essay on your website, we see, called 10 Things I've Learned, with some great sections like, you can only work for people you like. And if you have a choice, never have a job. Everybody has these luxuries, you know. But there's one called Less is Not Necessarily More, which I think might be surprising coming from someone known for such simple, iconic work. So what do you mean less is not necessarily more?
Well, not all works are susceptible to the same formula. Everything is in context. Sometimes you need to be more complicated in order to explain a simple thing. I mean, there's no generality or rule that applies to all cases. And this kind of attempt to unify everything into a simple, iconic statement just doesn't work. So you have to be adaptable and recognize, as I say, you have to recognize what is.
And being a creator of the iconic several times in your life, a few people are asking whether you ever cringe at the ubiquity of I Heart New York, or are you just like, gosh, I'm flattered, I'm so proud?
Well, I feel both. First, the inappropriateness of its application sometimes makes me cringe. And the fact that people think it's the only thing I ever did in my life sometimes makes me cringe. But otherwise, people like myself who enter this profession want to see their work have some effect. And the fact that it enters into human culture and is used is one of the reasons we go into it to begin with.
Is there a single most cringeworthy? Is it like I Heart New York, you know, boxers? Or is there a single most cringeworthy application of it?
Well, there are thousands, so I couldn't select one from all of the others.
You don't want to shout one out as an example?
Not really.
Milton Glaser, the designer who now has the button that represents that the Earth is dying, not warming. Again, where do people go? What's the website? If they want the button.
www.itsnotwarmingitsdying.com.
.com?
Yeah.
It's not warming, it's dying. And I know you can't put apostrophes in web addresses, so it's misspelled. It's not warming, it's dying. .com for Milton Glaser's button. Thank you. Always an honor.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.